Please join me in welcoming Michael Hill, president of the Chautauqua Institution. So, Michael, you've been in South Dakota for 16 hours?
Yep.
First visit. What do you think?
It's amazing. First you throw me with the husband thing, and I'm like, now what do you think of South Dakota? My colleague Shannon, who's traveling with me, and I were laughing and picking on you a little bit this morning because Chautauqua is in a rural area. So this is actually more of a metropolis for us than what we're used to, with a lot of similar weather. So for everyone who thought we ducked the weather and we would have been really traumatized a couple days ago, we're used to it.
So have you seen Mount Rushmore?
No.
Crazy Horse?
No.
The Badlands?
No. We've seen you.
We've been great hosts.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Chautauqua, the environment around Chautauqua first,
yeah.
And then we'll then a description of Chautauqua. So around Chautauqua, where does Chautauqua come from?
So
the word.
Oh, the word. The word's actually a Native American word that closest translation that sticks is a purse that's tied in the middle. So it's placed on a lake that has two basins and a skinny part in the middle. So the ideology or the thought is that you would have had a larger purse tied it in the satchel to have two compartments, and that's what our lake looks like where we're based on.
And around Chautauqua, the lake, is Chautauqua Institution.
Yep.
What else?
There's another 22 municipalities around the lake. Chautauqua itself is a study in contrast because it has incredible resources and yet it's placed in one of the most impoverished counties in New York State. And so as you go around the lake, you hit pockets that have been turned into resort areas, and then you can go a half or a quarter of a mile and see just incredible poverty with folks that are barely making it, and you can travel all the way around the lake that way.
Let's talk about Chautauqua Institution, mm-hmm. and in three or five sentences, how would you describe that?
So somewhere our marketing people are recording this because it's the curse of Chautauqua. It's almost 150 years old, and it does so much that it defies the elevator pitch, but I'll try.
Okay.
I'll try to give you three sentences. So the sentence on history is that we were founded as a Methodist Sunday school training camp, and over these 140 plus years have evolved into an institution that explores the best in human values through two different prisms. Intergenerational, so no generation has the answer, and multimedium, so no medium has the answer. So it's the arts, recreation, religion, and education that the institution looks at issues through.
And do I understand correctly that Chautauqua Institution's focus in the last 40 years has been on a 9-week summer program, but that summer program actually has its grounding in when it was first started?
Yeah, so the mission hasn't really changed that much. The iterations of the mission has. We have, to your point, we've landed in the last four decades on 3,000 events over 9 weeks. So this sleepy town of 140 full-time residents, because Chautauqua is also a town, and by virtue of being its president, I'm the unelected mayor. That's fun. Try that one. Including snow removal and water service. So,
do you have a city council?
We don't. My board of trustees decides whether I'm mayor or not. And on snow days, I'm like, they can have it. But it goes from this sleepy town of 140 people overnight to 10,000 people showing up. And abandoned houses show up. We have 140 public plus buildings that we do presentations in. And for the past 40 years, it's focused on that summer season. But at the height of the Chautauqua movement, and you had two Chautauquas here, about 17 years and 25 years after we were founded, at the height of that movement, 30 million people in the United States were involved in some similar form of exploration based on what was started in Western New York.
So just to give some time frame on that. So 17 years and 20 years after Chautauqua Institution was started, the state was 2 years old and 7 years old, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the two locations of Chautauqua in South Dakota,
yep.
in this new state were in
Okay, so the first on Lake Madison, north of Sioux Falls, was established in 1891, lasted to 1933. Second on Big Stone Lake in the northeastern corner of the state, on the border of Minnesota, established in 1899 and lasted until 1925.
And there's actually Chautauqua Park down in Hot Springs, yeah. South Dakota. So when you look, go around this lake and there's a diverse, there's a lot of diversity. You bring in, there are 10,000 people that come to Chautauqua over the summer and then leave. What else do you find around your lake?
Yeah, so it's such a fascinating place. And it's 10,000 people on any given day. 100,000 plus people come over the 9-week season. You will find traditional lake communities where people have built up big houses, but then you'll also find people who have just been on the lake for generations as farmers and have small cottages, or you'll find fishermen that have been there for a long time. And it's one of the things we struggle most with. How do we do what we do with all the resources we have and yet be a good neighbor in this county that's so unbelievably impoverished? You know, how do you mobilize resources to help people? And that's actually something we've just spent probably the last 3 years really focusing on. During the season, it's a gated community. You need a ticket to come in. And one of the things that I said when I was hired as president was, how do we turn our gates into gateways? How do we not have that be a closed off set of resources? And we've done a lot in the last 3 years with just cracking open the institution for kids, started an arts and education program that initially was with about a couple hundred kids. Our last 6 month status was 25,000 kids in four rural counties. With partnerships with Carnegie Hall and the Kennedy Center. And so we keep trying to figure out that way to be a good neighbor, all while knowing that the only way we stay open is we invite people to pay for a ticket to come in during the summer.
Yeah, so what's the average person that walks into Chautauqua? What's the average person look like socioeconomically?
Yeah, so there's no average person, and a part of it is because we've focused hard on trying to find ways to let anyone in who wants to come in. So you have the uber wealthy and folks that own houses on the grounds. I mean, the NFL commissioner owns a house on the grounds. The people that created, what's that liquid that you rub on your hand, the antibacterial liquid. You'll have people that founded insurance companies, and then you'll have folks who, you know, their great-great-great-grandfather came as a minister, and they just keep passing the house down, and they're no more affluent than any other person. So there's no typical. I think what we are challenged by based on our business model is, how do you make sure that a place that was founded for preachers and teachers, actually there's a conduit for preachers and teachers to come in?
You began your role as president of Chautauqua Institution in January of 2017. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping you'll talk a little bit about the path that you were on that brought you to Chautauqua, that led you to Chautauqua.
Yeah, so I didn't expect to land at Chautauqua by a long shot. I went to school in rural western New York. I went to a Catholic school, St. Bonaventure University, for journalism. And landed at Chautauqua the first time because I had decided after all of my education to turn down a job at the New York Times and not be a journalist. And my advisor was really, really ticked off. And I said, I think I want to do something in the arts. And she said, well, you know, go be an arts journalist. Go to Chautauqua. They have this daily newspaper. So it was a ploy on her part to save my journalism career, which failed. She's still angry. But I was at their daily newspaper as an assistant editor and just fell in love with this place that, as you walked across the grounds, I mean, it has its own symphony orchestra, its own opera company, its own theater company. You see students under gas lamps playing at 2 a.m. trying to make extra money. It has writers and artists and theologians. There's a house for almost every major world religion on the grounds that's trying to figure out what's happening in society. And went off to grad school, came back for 5 years intermittently in the summer to be a guest critic. I will tell you that no one should let a 20-year-old be a critic of anything. And no one should let that ever show up in writing. First day on the job, our communications director found all those reviews and left them on my desk. It was mortifying. But so I had always loved the place, but Chautauqua had a history of hiring as its president, folks who were at the very end of their careers. My predecessor spent most of his career there, but when a presidency would show up there, they would find a 65-year-old retired college president and say, this is a great last job for you, and throw him in there. I left Western New York to move to Washington, D.C., and held all sorts of weird jobs that, you know, fate's an interesting thing. You land someplace later and go, oh, that's why I was supposed to do that. So I worked on a capital campaign. I ran a capital campaign to rebuild the first regional theater in America, Arena Stage. Then went off to the National Cathedral and spent 4 years trying to figure out their public communications and development activities with a dean who thought he could save Christianity. He wanted to start a movement of generous-spirited Christianity. So that was lots and lots of fun. Mm-hmm. Lots of fun watching him get death threats about every other week. Then went to the ballet, spent some time in disability rights, and ultimately landed at a job that I thought I would stay at for years and years. I was working with, I was the president and CEO of Youth for Understanding, which works with thousands of international exchange students across the globe, and was in 21 countries every year talking to kids about how soft diplomacy might just save the world. Was about to sign a new contract and got nominated for the Chautauqua job and thought, I'm fine. I am not a 65-year-old retired college president. And came out the other end 6 months later of the search, quite honestly befuddled that they had picked me. And landed back in Western New York on a snowy, snowy, snowy day, wondering what the hell had just happened.
Michael, why do you think they picked you?
You know, I think Chautauqua was asking a lot of questions that most not-for-profits are asking. It has a business model that has catered to folks that are in the later part of their journeys. It needs a lot more folks in the earlier part of their journeys. It hadn't shaken things up in a long time, and I think they were looking at business models and saying, what does it mean for a place who asks you to turn off your technology and engage in long form? In a world in which if you walk down the street, most people are still doing this as they're walking. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that look like? I think some of the board thought, yeah, hire the young guy, he'll figure it out, which is always humorous to me. But I also think Chautauqua has always valued having someone that understands its history and has relationship with it. So those crazy 6 years of writing things about artists I had no right to write about, I think at least the founding premise for the interviews was, we don't have to teach him what this place is. And I think for a lot of other folks, until it's why your question about give me 3 to 4 sentences drives every marketing person on my team nuts. We don't have 3 to 4 sentences. Mm-hmm. And they felt they didn't have 6 months to teach someone what it was before they could start doing the work ahead.
And what would your answer be to some of those questions about what does it look like in the future? How do you connect with the youth or majority of society that's holding their phone while they're walking?
Well, you know, here's what's interesting, because in the early conversations with trustees, one of the things that they fretted was, well, young people won't like what we do because, you know, again, our signature program that draws the most people, so we're each of the 9 weeks is a theme that we explore. 4,000 people show up for a lecture in the amphitheater. That is a 45-minute talk with 45 minutes of questions, Q&A with citizens. And they said, well, you know, young people won't sit still that long. And baloney, young people download to our podcasts. So one of the questions that we started to ask was, it's not that young people don't want to convene. It's not that young people don't want to have serious conversations. It's that they convene differently. So what would it look like if instead of lecture to question, it's lecture to open air plaza around fire pits talking about what's on their minds? Young people aren't religious anymore. Well, if you look at most of the studies, young people may not define themselves with a mainstream religious tradition, but almost 80% of young people say they're on some sort of a spiritual journey. Chautauqua was founded to capture that hunger for inquiry, and it has iterated multiple times, but I think we got lazy in the last 40 years saying there is one blueprint on how to do this work, and you either fit into it or you don't. And I kept saying, after reading a lot more Chautauqua history, we've never taken that stance. When did we get so complacent where we didn't look at the world and say, our mission hasn't changed? We got stuck on how we delivered versus what we were delivering. And that's the journey we're on right now.
Do you think that's a parallel journey with the country as a whole?
Yeah, I do. I think a lot of the polarization that we see today is a mix of fear to try something different, and a lack of decoding of how to show up in a world that's gotten a lot more complicated. There's a study recently that said, because of our interface with technology, our brains are literally physically being rewired, so that the generation that's coming up now can process massive volumes of information, but they can process it in 15 to 20 second bites, right? So the human brain can take in more, but it can't sit in long contemplative conversation. Now that's of our own choosing. You know, we have an opportunity to reverse that, but how do you engage on complex topics that eclipse a 25-second soundbite?
Mm-hmm. Let's put some more...
Love you for this, by the way.
The 9 weeks this past summer, mm-hmm. Can we go through some of the themes that you guys had and then some of the speakers just to give some more context?
Yeah, so you know, what Chautauqua tries to do over 9 weeks is put its finger on the pulse of what mostly the nation, but sometimes the world is wrestling with. It tries really hard not to pick a political or ideological point of view. And it tries to curate artists and preachers and theologians and everyday folks to provide some sliver of a big thesis. So each week has a question that we're curious about. And we try to bring as many disparate points of view together. And what we say to those that come is, hang tight. If we do our job right, we will both infuriate you and delight you on any given day. And if you have only heard that which you agree with, we've epically failed, mm-hmm. right? Fascinating in a country where we were chatting a little bit about this yesterday. It is now possible to only turn the television on or subscribe to news that says exactly what you think or believe. And matter of fact, most of us do that. It is now possible, and we have led ourselves, even with families, to avoid anyone that might challenge our assumptions. And we have made it an art form of closing off our minds when we hear something that makes us uncomfortable. The antithesis of that is what we try to do at Chautauqua. And I get yelled at on a regular basis from people who have heard something that they didn't like that day. And I said, don't worry, yours is tomorrow, right? And invariably they'll come and be like, oh, but today was really good. And I was like, but how do you put the two together? So to your point, we look at things like, one of my favorite weeks was, is the Supreme Court at a tipping point? You know, has the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was an open-ended question. Maybe it isn't at a tipping point, but in the constitutional system, has the Supreme Court been invaded so much so that it can't look objectively at judicial opinions? We ended last year with Wynton Marsalis looking at what does art have to teach us about race in America, which ended up being much more an exploration about what do older generations have to teach younger generations. So he invited a whole bunch of younger artists who were like, oh yeah, we have to think about the next generation. And Wynton is just crazy committed to elders. And he's like, crap with the younger generation. They haven't figured out anything yet. What they need is their elders to step up, and they need to shut up and listen a little bit more. And you could watch every young person be like, oh. A week on, and I love picking on my colleagues about this, one of the really fun things about being president is, you know, our 9 weeks get theme tested and market tested, and I get really frustrated. That one won't sell. And I'm like, but that's, you know, what we should be talking about. So every season I usually pick a theme that drives my staff crazy because they're like, no one wants to hear that. So we did an entire week on grace. Is grace possible in the non-religious or the religious context? And Krista Tippett came and taped her show on being live in the amphitheater every day. And brought people that you've probably never heard about to talk about the struggles they were facing. And the thesis was, is it still possible in this world that's so polarized to see expressions of grace? If the answer is yes, how do you seize them and carry them forward? And if we're successful, what might that do to heal a broken world? It was one of our best-selling weeks. Mm-hmm. lucky on my part, right? I mean, there are other times where I pick and they're like, we told you that wasn't going to work. But that's one of the things I love about this institution is we go in with questions, not answers. And I think that's what's ailing society is too often we go into interactions with answers and we don't care about the questions. And I think that's the trick on can we put it all back together.
Has it always been that way?
It's always been that way.
Has it always been that way that you go in with questions? It sounds like at Chautauqua you've always gone in with questions. But has it always been that? Have we always looked at our society with the answers and not the questions? Has that changed?
You know, one of the things about being a student of history, and Ken Burns is a favorite at Chautauqua. He comes often, and I love him for that. Ken gives this talk where, and he gave, the last time I heard this was during the last presidential election. And he describes this narrative, and he says, you know, the United States is more divided than it's ever been. And you have someone running on the right who the left thinks is literally the second coming of Satan, and someone on the left who they think will destroy every moral fabric. And he's describing all of these things, and everyone's getting a little uncomfortable thinking that Ken's gonna talk about the Trump-Clinton race. And he says, you know, we survived Jefferson and Adams. So I don't know. I think the nation has always had agitas about itself. And I think its citizens have always struggled. I think what's different now that we have to figure out is in an era in which you can propel your objections through social media and cable news without reasoned thought, I think that's different. I split my time between the institution and Washington, D.C. We have an office there, and I'm always love the whiplash of going from, oh, stars, great, and I can't see another human being to, oh, God, where are the stars? But one of the things that the political class in Washington will tell you has changed is it used to be the case that elected officials would debate until the evening newspaper came out, and the evening news ended around, depending on what time zone you're in on the East Coast, 7 p.m. And then they had a good 12 hours before the morning paper came out to sit down and talk to one another. Gone, right? So I think that's different. And I think we have to figure that out. How do you shut down the noise? I don't have an answer for it, but I think that's what's different.
Do you think we talk to each other differently?
I think we don't talk to each other. I think we lob things at each other. I think we go in with our playbooks and our of words. I think, you know, so you and I've chatted a lot about Chautauqua keeps talking about its current mission is around civil dialogue, and people instantly go to, all right, so how do I debate better? I'm like, the word debate has no place in civil dialogue. Civil dialogue starting with listening first, seeking to understand before being understood, trying to place empathy on conversations, understand really what's behind someone else's motives or issues or beliefs. Challenge yourself, anyone in the audience, the next time you're sitting next to that relative at the dinner table that you were like, oh my God, why did they place me next to Aunt Sally? Our gut instinct when we talk about the things we disagree is to load up our play deck of why we're right and to convince Aunt Sally that she's wrong versus why do you believe what you believe? Underneath what you believe, is there something you're afraid of I need to understand? Let me help you understand what I'm afraid of or why I believe what I believe, and is there commonalities? I think if we did more of that, and I'm always amazed by this, and I said this to you yesterday, because I live in both a rural area and an urban area, the gun debate for me is all over the map. So when I'm in Chautauqua, you know, my staff all goes out on hunting day. My dad tried taking me out until he realized I couldn't shut up in the deer stand. I have no problem with that. I go to my condo in an incredibly diverse neighborhood in Washington, and the week I moved in, three people were shot and killed at the end of my street. My relationship with guns couldn't be more different based on where I'm situated. And yet, when I've had the ability to get into a conversation with someone for whom gun rights is a heritage issue, I agree with 97% of what's there. But I think we start that debate with, you know, when I'm in Washington and someone got killed, you want to take my guns away. Now, when I'm over here, you know, it's, well, if we just dealt with mental health, those are our playbooks. When you strip away what most Americans are wrestling with, we're arguing around the fringes. We never get there. And I think that's what we have to figure out, is how do we, as a nation, realize that we're actually not that far apart, but we never get to the fringe 3% because we're too busy arguing the 97%.
So why is it that playbook, why does the deck get stacked? Why are we trained to stack the deck? Separate question, but I love to hear your thoughts on that. Like, why do you think we stack that deck and we're ready to go? But you have to listen to my reason of what you just... the other is, I think empathy has a huge place.
Massive.
In society. And you... Are we no longer empathetic as a society? Do we know how to be empathetic?
You know, my mother would tell you that I came out of the womb Pollyanna-ish and believing that the glass is half full, and I'm fairly convinced I'll die that way. So I'm going to give you the optimist answer on that. I do think at the core, and we see this unfortunately in times of great tragedy, natural disasters, I mean, 9/11, right? I mean, we went from being a polarized nation to a singularly purposed nation instantly. So the capacity exists. How we get there without needing a catastrophe is an interesting question. And I think the deck gets stacked partially based on our lack of desire to be uncomfortable. So one of the things we'll talk about at Chautauqua during the summer is I'll say, look, if all you ever watch is Fox, spend a week with MSNBC and vice versa. And you can just watch people start to, you know. There was a report I was reading this morning that said there are some mainstream conservative media outlets that literally won't talk about the fact that an impeachment hearing has started today. Not whether it's bad or good. They won't even talk about that it's happened. So you've got that on the far extreme. You've got other liberal outlets that are presenting it as if Martians have just landed on the planet and it's the only thing to cover, right? So we stack our own deck. We drive ourselves to a place of being comfortable. I think not because we're intentionally desirous of being ignorant. I think the world is chaotic enough that we find comfort in hearing that which props us up. I think it's harder to hear things that challenge us. And yet, I run an institution that's predicated on that entire notion. And anytime someone screams at me, I'm like, you picked the wrong vacation. Like, the whole point of what we do is to make you uncomfortable. So I'm on vacation. Why did you put that guy up there? Go to Disney. Like, you know, that's not what we do. He said something I didn't like. Okay, yeah, it's a perspective.
What were you most uncomfortable with this summer?
Oh, God. I think what we are consistently most uncomfortable with, and it's kind of funny. So we will say at the end of each week, and absolutely at the end of each season, there's this great tradition that I deeply love that has we've never let go of. So you will sometimes hear Chautauqua called the assembly, and we'll talk about the summer assembly season. And when Chautauqua was founded, it had no year-round presence. I mean, we had the land, but people would come on vacation. Vacation wasn't in vogue in 1874. It was not, you know, oh my God, you're going to go relax someplace. So no, we're going to study and learn. So the assembly would assemble. And the first president was tasked with giving kind of a state of what they thought that was going to be explored that summer. Where was the world in context of what they were looking at? And there is this gavel, and you would tap the assembly into session. Conversely, at the end of 9 weeks, there's a mirror speech that talks about what have we learned this summer, where do we go from here, and you close out the assembly. So I tap the gavel 3 times, Chautauqua 2019 has concluded. Which I always chuckle because I'm like, I still have to plow the streets. Nothing's concluded. But in that, one of the things we've said is the goal is not to come to Chautauqua to be entertained or educated and you've checked a box. The goal is to take what you've learned here back to your own communities and make it better. And so that was a fun thing to say in my first year. And in the second year, people were really digging into this civil dialogue thing. I got yelled at for calling it muscular civil dialogue. That sounded, you know, anti-feminist. All sorts of crazy stuff was going on. And at the end of the second year, they said, all right, fine, how do we do it? I don't have the answer. We're spending a lot of time right now, mostly in partnership with others, trying to find answers for people who say, fine, swallowed the Kool-Aid, other than me watching the cable news station that opposite of what I normally watch, how do I sit next to the person who I disagree with and have an honest, authentic conversation? Not having that answer drives me crazy. I think that's the pursuit. The rest of the stuff, you know, the people that yell and scream and don't want to be challenged, that's just part of the role. I think we have to figure out as a collective citizenry how we're willing to get uncomfortable with one another. The former academic in me wants to put a pedagogy to it. Mm-hmm. I haven't figured it out yet.
There seems to be an emphasis on the arts at Chautauqua. Can you share why the arts are important?
Yeah, so it's really one of the things that cracks me up, and it goes back to your question about three sentences, is each of our pillars has a robust set of programming underneath it. And depending on why you showed up at Chautauqua, you think that's the thing we most do. So yeah, we've got basically a graduate conservatory. Hundreds of kids come to study with some of the best faculty in the world who give up their summers to come teach at Chautauqua. There's an arts campus that has incredible, I mean, we've got an entire multi-million dollar building for chamber music. Okay. One of the things the founders believed, and it's one of the reasons I think these pillars are still intact, is that as you look at the complex issues, as human beings, we're not meant to find the answer in one spot. So I mentioned 4,000 people come to a lecture. That feels much more like the base education we know. Expert up front, they present a series of information, you collectively look at that over a week, you ask questions, you process. I think it's still the case, regardless of whether you identify with a mainstream religious organization or not, that people believe that there is something larger that they don't understand. This exploration of the divine is still a part of our human desire to understand the world. And a lot of that is based in words. You know, so you think about you and I are having a dialogue, we're gonna get something from that. That third pillar of the arts is when words don't cut it, how do you explore something? And in most instances, if you look at when art has been transformative in society, it's when an artist has said, yeah, but the question you're not asking is this. You know, even in classical music, you look at some of when Tchaikovsky's writing and there's riots, or Stravinsky, you know, and it's because they've asked a more profound question and pushed the envelope. One of my favorite examples, and there is a culture clash happening at Chautauqua because despite some who think it's extremely liberal, it's a pretty conservative place. And the one issue that the community itself has not figured out is today's generation's notion of gender fluidity. Mm-hmm. So the LGBT community, but mostly on the T part, the notion that that you're on the spectrum. And so we were trying to talk about what does it mean for a generation that doesn't put itself in a binary world? How do we access that? How do we understand that? And lectures weren't cutting it. People were getting really frustrated, and I want to talk about that, or I don't want to talk about that, or why do you think we need to talk about that? Our opera company did a one-day piece, a piece called As One, that was about a trans woman and then did a series of conversations afterwards for like collectively 4 hours. I saw more people who swore they would never show up engage in a conversation because they were trying to understand. It's because the opera was the window for them. And most of these folks didn't even like opera, which was the really befuddling thing. In that mode of inquiry, I think the arts allow us to tackle or ask questions and to feel things that just aren't safe in regular conversation. So it's one of the reasons that we lean so heavily into it.
You said people are searching or curious or seeking the divine. Mm-hmm. What do you think most people are actually seeking outside of the divine? What are people looking for?
I think people are trying to understand their lives in the context of the world in which they live. I don't think let's localize it to just Americans. I don't think Americans are on any different journey than they've ever been. I think the founding premise of wanting a good life, wanting to love your family, wanting to be in community that feels safe for you, wanting a pathway to being able to grow old gracefully. I think all of those core desires are still there. I think we've chosen some different portals to find them. That's why, you know, you look at this generation and they say, oh, they're not religious. And I'll say, yeah, but they're still on the journey. It's just a different conduit for what they're looking for. We'll actually look at a week this coming summer that's in our interfaith series. So we do a 10:45 main lecture series, and then there's a 2 o'clock interfaith companion series that says, what do all the world's religions have to teach us about this question? And one of the interfaith series is, can art help us glimpse the divine for a generation that believes God has checked out and said, I'm no longer here? What does that look like? And can we understand that?
Why do you suppose, as people are on that journey, if we're all on that journey, why do you suppose it matters so much where other people are?
You know, that's a great question, and I wish I had the answer. We talk a lot about, during this quest, and you and I have chatted, so one of the things Chautauqua was trying to do is go from 9 weeks to year-round, and a part of it is because I think people are so hungry. I am fascinated by the tendency to prevent others from achieving what they need to be okay with what I need. And this shows up in all sorts of different ways in our discourse as a nation. When what someone else needs does not infringe on your need, I'm always perplexed why we club each other in those moments. I wish I had the answer. I think if I did have the answer, Chautauqua probably could close and tap that gavel permanently. I think human beings in general have always tried to not be afraid. And I think right now, based on polarized media, based on the fact that we don't do enough of what you and I are doing this morning, we live in the fear space more than the understanding space. And if you're operating from a place of fear, your gut reaction is to punch your way out, right? I think we keep trying to punch our way out.
What's the most important characteristic of a leader?
Where does this guy come from? You know, we're having a nice conversation about civil dialogue, and then what's the most important characteristic of a leader? Whoever you have next, have him call me first.
Just say how wonderful this experience is.
Yes. 7 a.m. at the garage. What's the most important characteristic of a leader? God bless America. I think in today's day and age, it really is around courage, because I don't think there's an easy roadmap. I mentioned I'm traveling with a colleague and friend of mine. We've just put out a strategic plan that asks us to literally turn the institution upside down on its ear. We spent 18 months listening to what was on people's minds and put it together and said, this is what we heard from you. It is the scariest thing I've ever attempted to do professionally or personally, and yet it's the right thing to do. I mean, you told me an origin story about this place. I mean, you put bathrooms in the middle because the banks told you this would never work. Well, it's still here.
Any bankers?
I think that ability to see the future you want and the courage to run after it, even if it means you're going to fall and stumble and might not get there on the path you thought, is what's most missing in leadership today. You know, the number of times my colleagues tell me I'm absolutely crazy is many, but now they're becoming crazy with me. So, I think it's courage to face that which doesn't have a clear path.
Because of failure?
I think people are afraid of failure, but I also think we've landed in this place where optimists are doubted, which is totally fascinating to me in the context of what our country is, right? I mean, this is our national narrative is one of optimism. And so I don't know how we've missed that along the way, but I think leaders' ability to paint a picture of a better world and to say, it's okay that we don't know how to get there, but let's start, is what's most missing.
There's like a whole
nother hour. He has this little pursed lips moment where I'm like, now what's coming?
That would be a whole nother conversation, which would be really fun. But let's not go there, let's go here, which is, what's your favorite piece of art?
You're killing me, man. I swear to God, I grew up in the middle of nowhere and the most uncultured family on the planet, and I'm gonna give you the snootiest, snottiest answer that's gonna make you think I'm something I'm not. I grew up extremely poor. I grew up near a state university that had a really cool school of music, and I've always said that the arts allowed me to see a world that I had no reason to see. It wasn't the world my family walked in. It wasn't a world I ever should have glimpsed. And this crazy, and I think about this all the time, like I'm on the plane coming to South Dakota and I thought, when did I become someone that was interesting enough to have a conversation over coffee at 7 a.m. in South Dakota? Because that's not how I grew up, right? Long apologetic way of saying that my favorite piece of art is by a Polish composer named Heinrich Gorecki, who wrote a piece called The Symphony of Sorrowful Songs after the Holocaust. His mother did not survive the Holocaust, and he writes this piece about years later going to Auschwitz and seeing inscribed on a wall a crude poem that when she understands that she's not going to make it out, she inscribes this prayer that basically says, I hope that wherever my son is, that flowers are there to grace him the way that my perfume did when he was a child. I hope that he sees beauty. I hope that he sees joy. And it's just this stunning piece of music that I've always gotten lost in. And goes back to the eternal optimist. How at the very worst definition of hell for a human being do you write a prayer of hope? I actually think that's what humanity is made of. I've always believed that. And so it's my favorite piece. It's never gonna bust out on any charts, and it makes me sound super snotty, but you know, I tripped on it. I don't even know how I came about it, but I've always loved it.
Thanks.
What else you got in those cards?
Would you talk about a mentor? Have you had a mentor?
Yeah.
How important are mentors?
Mentors are super important. So I've had two that have really profoundly influenced my life. One was a high school science teacher, and if to know me is to know that although I dreamt of being an astronaut when I was a kid, when I realized I knew nothing about science and would never be good at it, that dream probably wasn't going anywhere, who in the midst of an incredibly impoverished small town found kids who he thought had ability and did all sorts of things to make sure that they got out, succeeded, and I was one of those kids. He is, for anyone that's read Tuesdays with Maury, he is my Maury. And, you know, would probably, no one would pick him as the hero, you know, never showed up on Time magazine, but this guy, the number of kids that he looked for, found, and I would say saved is huge. And the other is a guy who worked at United Cerebral Palsy who, by any definition in the exterior, should not have shown up as a champion for disability rights, who taught me to think much more broadly about civil rights movements. So when I went to work for him, he described people with disabilities trying to find equality as the last great civil rights movement and as the invisible civil rights movement. And his bigger point was, how do you look for the people that no one else sees and try to figure out how to get them seen? And that mode of inquiry has always stuck with me. You know, how do you, whether you're in your own community or you're talking nationally or internationally, who's invisible? Why are they invisible? And how do you make it okay that they're not invisible? Mm-hmm. So folks that ask mean questions like you, you know.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Oh, Matt. You know, I think it's much more in those mentors, and both of them gave different versions of this. It's the, if you want something, if you believe in something, literally do not stop, no matter how hard it is. And, you know, as I think about different journeys or things that have happened in my life, there's just so many times where I should have just said, nope, that's probably not what I meant to do, and gave up. And that notion of, if you want it bad enough, keep going.
Is there a piece of advice that you think you've given?
Oh, gosh. I'd like to think I passed those things on. Funny story about Chautauqua, and it's one of the reasons I love it, and I don't share it often. So when I went that first summer to be assistant editor of the paper, I was still dirt poor, and I pick on Chautauqua all the time, and now I'm in charge of it, which is the ultimate irony, because it paid me enough to basically give them all my money back in rent to stay and write there. And I got accepted into grad school and didn't have enough money to go, and so I wasn't going to go to grad school. Had a broken down car, couldn't figure out how I was going to get out to Minnesota, had never been to Minnesota. And this woman who had been orphaned and raised by nuns in Poland, who had immigrated to the United States, who had become this really cool artist, shortened a very long story, said that she had been praying on it and knew that I probably wasn't going to go to grad school, and if it was because of money, gave me a pocket of cash and said that the only thing she wanted me to do is, when I saw someone that I believed in, to do whatever I could to take the barriers out of their way. I feel like so much of my life has been, you know, glimpsing the divine, has been the divine putting those people in my pathway at the right moments for me to keep going. So I hope I do that for others. That's something I challenge myself a lot about. But I think if we all adopt that ethos, the world would be a far better place. I've been the tremendous beneficiary of that in my life.
Remembering the history of Chautauqua and up to today, what do you suppose has stayed constant over the almost 150 years? What has changed most significantly?
I think the mission stayed constant, and the words haven't changed all that much. Chautauqua's mission is to explore the best in human values and to use that exploration to create dynamic solutions and communities for change. It's why it was founded by an Ohio industrialist and a Methodist bishop. And at each iteration of its life, whether it's done things where it's been much more present, you know, so it launched the Chautauqua Literary and Scientific Circle, which was the first distance learning course at the height of it. You had
it's about 10 years ago, right? You guys did that?
Yeah, God. It's been in existence since 1887. I have a library in the president's residence at Chautauqua that has all of the books that went on in the correspondence course. 1900s, it was asking the nation to look at Islam. Like 1902. What's Islam?
Let's pause for a second. So the first distance learning program was started in
1887, yeah.
By mail.
Yeah.
From Chautauqua Institute.
Would ship books out, and there were reading circles. There were reading circles here in South Dakota. So I think that belief that human beings need to immerse themselves across disciplines to find answers is the constant. It's never changed. It's who we are. I think how we've delivered it has changed dramatically. I mean, the first folks that came to Chautauqua set up tents. We have $1 billion in buildings now. That's a little different.
Mm-hmm.
So this next journey for us is different. You know, how are we again moving to a place of year-round engagement? How do we think about communities engaging with Chautauqua and never ever showing up on our grounds? What does that look like? How do we harness the tools that are available for us today to have a bigger conversation?
What's the thread? What is the criteria for someone who comes to Chautauqua to lecture, speak, be on panels? Is there a through thread?
So, yes and no. Each week we start with a central thesis. What fascinates me is the duality of who shows up on our stages and in our pulpits. And because, look, Chautauqua also has to stay open. It's got an okay endowment, but not one that would sustain it without selling tickets and bringing people. And so we know that in any given week, we have to put at least one name on our lecture platform or in our pulpits that is like, oh my God, they got that person? I would say to you almost always, that is the biggest dud lecture we do. It's the, gosh, I've never heard of X, and they just blew my mind. So we did a week, I think it was my second year, that was looking at race and religion, and we brought Jesse Jackson, and we brought all these other folks. It was Clara Esther, who happened to be with Martin Luther King the moment he was shot, held him as he was bleeding, who receded into obscurity. We had a speaker cancel on us, and I have no idea. Our director of religion said, what about Clara Esther? And we all went, okay. Sent us like some Wikipedia thing about Clara Esther, who flew up with 12 hours notice, and gave the most powerful reflection on what still needs to happen with civil rights in America, blew everyone away. Jesse Jackson was okay. You know, so, I don't know, we both need to sell, and we're constantly looking for the prophetic voice that hasn't received amplification yet. And I think what we most often find is when we give them a stage, they're the ones that lead us to something different.
Two questions.
No one tell Jesse Jackson that, by the way. He's great.
The role of liberal arts education mm-hmm. and critical thinking. 2 minutes.
Never inviting you. The garage is the lion's den. So 2 minutes on, does it...
the role of liberal arts education and critical thinking. Often today we talk about we have to go to school to get a job.
Yep.
And go learn this.
Yep. So I sit on a board of trustees of my alma mater, and this is playing out because small liberal arts schools that aren't crazy endowed are dying left, right, and center. What I think is so fascinating about that for parents who send their kids to school to get a job is that the world is changing so fast. By the time their education that they were given to get that job occurs, that industry's moved on.
Mm-hmm.
What every job needs is critical thinkers. That's what a liberal arts education teaches. We've got to find a way to stomach that young people need to think critically across disciplines to be able to do any job, and that has to be okay. I think if we don't, we're dumbing down our citizenry in a way that will hurt us exponentially, because the jobs are just changing too fast. So whether it's, you know, and my own alma mater is wrestling with this, and the short-term rewards are there. So we've never been in the health professions. We just launched the School of Health Professions. It saved our enrollment. You know, medicine will change every 2 to 3 years. I don't know that we can win that dance long-term. I received a journalism degree. I'm not doing anything with journalism, but I was taught to think critically by all of those 4 years. I don't think there's anything that I'm not crazy enough to try. Had I not had a liberal arts core, I don't know, would I just be a journalist? And journalism is a noble profession, but I was taught that plus, you know, Plato's cave juxtaposed against how do you write a good first paragraph. Plato's still hanging out in the cave. We need to be there too.
We should just end on that. But my mom had a
question.
Turn
off the mic, sorry.
But in preparation, I was talking to my mom, and she made the point.
Always the mothers.
She made the point that while we were going to have this conversation, the nation would be focused and all newscasts focused on impeachment hearings.
Yeah.
And was curious about maybe your thoughts on that reality.
Thanks,
and
Mom.
And are we hearing what we're saying in Washington, D.C., like we're sitting listening
so
today, this morning?
I was trying to take my own advice this morning while I was getting ready to come here, and I was flipping across all the cable news channels to see if there was any common thread that each of the newscasters was sharing. And the only thing that was common this morning was the poll numbers. And the poll numbers that say that 49% of Americans not only believe impeachment is necessary, but that the president should be removed from office, and 47% believe the opposite. There's not much more definition of a divided nation when you throw in statistics that a country who literally is almost 50-50 split on the facts of what did or didn't happen and what should or shouldn't happen because of it. I think it is a symptom of what we've been talking about all morning. How do you have a conversation about whatever reality is, and how do good people come together to make reasoned judgments based on what they see? And I'm not, there's no hidden meta message in on that. I don't know what the right answer is on impeachment either, because I don't know that we have all of the information out there. But the fact that as a nation, we look at the same data and we're 50-50% split is the symptom to the disease you and I have been talking about all morning.
So Plato's still in his cave.
Plato is in his cave, waiting for
and
us.
And we should end with that. Thank you for joining us today.